Morning, everybody. Everything I say is me, not the governor. I want to put that on the front end. He and I are just getting to understand each other's working relationship, and I want to make sure that the way this works is he gets to make the final decision, and then I do what he tells me to do. So, but what I'm going to try to describe to you about what I think is going on in higher ed, and I think you can take from this is probably how I'm talking to him about it. But again, he gets to make the decision, and then Senator Dietzick and Representative Kahn and Loeffler get to make the decision on what to do next. All I'm going to try to do is describe what I think is going on. Two things on the front end. One, the basic presumption is, in our country, we kind of view higher ed as that opportunity to level the playing field for life. K-12 prepares you to be an independent learner, and then post-secondary education takes you further on that journey in career or personal aspirations. So that's fundamental in everything I'm going to say here. That's a fundamental belief that's what post-secondary is about. And it's an opportunity for people to level themselves again. Because if they work hard and get a good education, we think that will show up in returns in terms of both citizens of the democracy, but also economically. There's a lot of evidence that indicates, on average, that the higher your education level, the more money you're going to make. On average, that's a key point, because it doesn't work out for everybody. The second point then is, and this is going to be hard for us, for those of us who are 60 and older, of which I am one. The higher educational system that we live in today is pretty fundamentally different than the one after post-World War II. And so this notion that we did the GI Bill, everybody had universal access, it was a beautiful thing. Absolutely, that's what happened. That's not the world we live in today. Depending on how you do the calculation, between 75 and 82% of all the money in higher education comes out of the student and the family. Most of the money does not come from the taxpayer. Depending on how you do the calculation, between 70, and the reason I'm doing a range, I think it's over 80%, but just to play it safe, others would argue it's only 75%. So somewhere between 75 and 82% of the money in Minnesota spent in higher education comes out of your pocket, out of the consumer's pocket, not from the taxpayer. So it's basically a market-driven system. And again, I'm speaking for myself right now. I'm not sure others would use this exact terminology. So those are the two premises. I want to go through this on the left-hand side of the handout, just enough information so you have a better understanding of where we are at in higher ed. And then I want to spend most of the time talking about financial aid, which I think is the fundamental issue in higher ed right now. So just going through these quickly, and I tried to get them blown up so people could read them. When kids come out of high school, about 28% of them go out of state for post-secondary education. 14% to the state universities, 27% to community and technical colleges. And private 4 years is 14%, and the U of M is 13%. So more students go to private St. Thomas and St. John's than go to the University of Minnesota. And twice as many students go to community and technical colleges, Minneapolis Community College, Metro State, as go to the University of Minnesota. So even though we tend to be pretty University of Minnesota oriented here because of where we live, there's a segment there only. It's not the largest piece. This next chart talks about when they go, how long do they stay? This is, are you there a year later? And you can see from the first chart, the most important point there is students who start out at the two-year institutions, only about half of them are there a year later. University of Minnesota, obviously quite different than that. People start and tend to stay, but the graduation rates or the four, or depending on how you measure it, 4 or 5 or 6 year graduation rates are significantly higher in the private colleges than they are at the University of Minnesota. Keep in mind, the university and private colleges are both selective now. They all control enrollment and who they let in. But the retention rate, or the amount of the speed with which people graduate, is quicker at the private colleges. I don't mean that as a condemnation. I just mean it as a point of information. This next chart talks about who gets into college. And I won't go too deeply into it, because you all pretty much know these figures. But those who actually pass the exams to get in to their college of choice are pretty strongly correlated with income and race. For example, American Indian students are the least likely to graduate from high school and the least likely to get into college. Similar for all of the racial components. So the point here to keep in mind is, if we're going to hit the kind of college or post-secondary attainment rates we need, and Minnesota is very high, we rate like 3rd or 4th or 5th in the country right now, 66% of people from age 25 to 64 in Minnesota, 66% have 1 year of attainment or more of post-secondary education. This Georgetown study everybody talks about, as if it's the Bible, it estimates that Minnesota needs to be at 70% for the future workforce type thing. Well, we're already at 66%. But the key point is, because the incoming students are poor, percentage-wise, poor, and kids of color, the groups least represented in post-secondary now, that's our future, that's who's coming, it's going to be hard for us to maintain that level of attainment if we don't fix some things here. So we're doing well, but we shouldn't try to live on our laurels, because the demographics are just overcoming us. Post-secondary enrollment options, I just tossed this in, because there's this movement now to say, if a student is ready for college, let them go. Don't keep them in high school where they're bored. That's already happened. Because of Perpich and Company, that's already happened in Minnesota. As many as 23, almost 24,000 students are already taking post-secondary enrollment options in Minnesota. There are other versions of that, college in the school and various other things, but there's quite a bit of effort now to use 10th, 11th, and 12th grade when possible to get post-secondary attainment at the same time, because it's cheaper if you do that. Theoretically, if you both get your high school diploma and your AA degree by the time you leave high school, you've saved yourself 2 years of college cost. There's a lot of issues around that, whether that's a good idea or not. You know, it makes you wonder, is a high school diploma worth it? But from a consumer point of view, from a citizen's point of view, that makes a lot of sense, right? If you can do two things at once, do it. Enrollment by institutions. Again, this just reinforces most of the students are at public two-year colleges. And then it shows you graduate students versus undergrads. Interesting to point out, the private career, this is the proprietary, the for-profits, the bulk of that is graduate education, not undergraduate. They are starting to move more into undergraduate, and there's some reasons for that. But today, in Minnesota, the bulk of for-profit education is graduate education. That gets to that issue of whether somebody's being abused and used by a for-profit company. If someone's working on their PhD, you think about that a little differently, don't you? Is someone working on their PhD paying a higher price to get their doctorate, are they being abused somehow? And if they are, maybe we shouldn't be given a PhD. So to me, that talks a little bit about some of the consumer forces that are going on there in the market. I'm not saying that there aren't undergraduates that are being abused by the for-profits. I'm not saying that at all. I'm just trying to put it into context here. These are the trends on enrollment. And you can see the biggest increase as when we hit the economy was in two-year post-secondary. There's some trade-off between workforce and going to school. If you can't get a job, you kind of go, well, maybe I should go to school. Makes perfect sense, right? Some people who are, I would never use this word, but some people talk about post-secondary education as being a sponge for the economy. When there aren't jobs, it's a way of allowing people to do something productive while they're waiting to get back into the workforce. And again, you can see kind of how the others are all controlled, or not, well, that's the point. Their enrollment rates don't change that much because they're controlled. The university basically has limits on what it's going to take, St. John's, St. Thomas. The for-profits, you can see, or the proprietary is what they like to call themselves, proprietaries, they had a big increase too, just like MinSCU, 2 years. To me, that indicates that they probably are alike in some ways in terms of the type of person that is trying to attend those institutions. So in a market sense, they're in competition for students, the proprietaries and MinSCU, not so much the University of Minnesota or St. Thomas. More women, this is something I think most people are aware of. There's more women in higher ed now than there ever has been, and by quite a margin, 56 to 44. So don't know what's going on with those guys. And the student body is getting older. If you look at the if you look at where people are going to school, if the bulk of them are going to two-year campuses, those tend to be older students who either did not go to school right out of college or are coming back. Whereas the University of Minnesota, St. Thomas, what we traditionally think of as college, since they are controlling enrollment now, or they don't like the word control, they don't take everybody, they're not open enrollment. They're in that traditional group, right after high school group. But more and more of higher education now is becoming a non-traditional group of students, not your typical 18 to 24-year-old. They're becoming adults or young adults. Full-time, part-time. Community and technical colleges, half and half. More non-traditional students, half are full-time, half are part-time. And you can look at University of Minnesota and the private 4 years and the state universities. They're pretty, that's what you'd expect, right? The U of M, 41,000. These are undergraduates now. 41,000 of their undergrads are full-time. I was surprised to learn that 4,600 are part-time at the U. I guess I never knew anybody going part-time for their baccalaureate at the U, but apparently there are some. Enrollment by race and ethnicity. Won't go into detail, but you can look at it. The story here is not only are the groups underrepresented in higher ed in general, but the type of institution they go to is biased. They tend to go to two-year state colleges rather than the privates or the University of Minnesota as a percent. Not to say the university and the private colleges aren't doing a good job getting groups of those students there. I think actually university's percentages are getting quite much better. But this is the total number of students we're talking about. And since most of the students are going to two-year colleges, that's where most of these students are going. Keep that in mind when we get to this discussion of financial aid. I won't go through these, but these are the types of things people are studying for. They're getting degrees in. And I'll go over the one with all the numbers. Just look at the bachelor degree one. There are people going into STEM, but the biggest growth area is business. Don't pick on the lawyers as much anymore. It's kind of business. And you have a theory, and health sciences, obviously, on the bottom there. Tuition and fees. There are a million charts you can look at on all this, and it's a very complex issue. When we get into financial aid, I'll try to simplify it. But the price that you hear ain't the price. You know, St. Thomas, $30,000. That's not what it is. Some students pay $30,000 at St. Thomas, but probably about 75 or 80% of them pay something much closer to what you pay at the University of Minnesota. There's an institutional buy-down. The way I kind of think about it is if you're a private college, you want a high list price to show how much quality you are. If we're expensive, we must be really valuable. If you're a public university, since you have a land-grant mission, you like to say, we have low tuition. So I think that's kind of a way to think about it a little bit. What we know is that students going to private four-year colleges are direct, that is direct competition with the University of Minnesota. Those are the choices people are making. Do I go to St. Thomas or do I go to the University of Minnesota? Less likely are they saying, do I go to St. Thomas or do I go to Mankato State? That happens too, but it's more a little bit the University of Minnesota versus those types of institutions. And keep in mind, 28% are going out state. They're not even in our market in Minnesota. And interestingly, they're not all going to the Ivies. We have people going to Kansas, and I mean, it's really kind of interesting the choices people make to where they go to school. Tuition and fees, this next chart, I just want to make two points, and this will be controversial. The institutions would not agree with this, or would at least want to argue about this. There's quite a bit of data that indicates that the correlation between tuition and state money to institutions is very weak. I have a chart that shows that for the last 40 years or 30 years, no matter how much the legislature puts in, tuition just keeps kind of going. To me, that indicates that we're dealing in a market system unrelated to the pieces. Again, I know this is hard for Arvon, and I had a brief discussion about this at a funeral about a month ago, and she kind of looked at me like, Jesus! But it just seems there's growing evidence that the price is being set by a market, not by the level of state appropriations. And again, what I just said is not something that I think the institutions would agree with. Matter of fact, that's not how they're lobbying. But there's a growing amount of evidence. Keep in mind that 75 to 82% of the money comes from the consumer, not from the taxpayer. To me, that kind of, all right, maybe it is being set by forces different than what we think. My basic argument is I don't think that Carrie, Diane, and Phyllis can ultimately control tuition. Unless they're willing to put in a lot of money that gets you down into maybe 50-50 public versus private money, then maybe you do, I don't know, but even at 50-50 it doesn't work. But that's not a world we live in right now. We're at 75 to 82%. That's kind of the sum. Oh, and tuition and fees at all these institutions are going up, have been going up for years at two times the rate of inflation, over two times the rate of inflation, over two times the rate of cost of living. Again, some evidence that it's unrelated to what we're trying to do in public policy over the long term. I'm not saying as a one-time event you can't impact it. Obviously, University of Minnesota just put that on the table. If you give us $42 million, we'll freeze tuition. Absolutely, that can work. But I'm arguing over the long term, you have to wonder whether that can work. Episodically, it absolutely can. I mean, if the university cuts that deal, I guess they'll hold tuition down for 2 years. Okay, then I want to get into, the next two charts are about this 75, and I won't go through them. It's about this who pays. And what has happened is the more the money comes out of for higher ed, think about it this way, about $7 billion in higher ed expenditures in Minnesota, $6 billion of it comes out of families or out of students, out of the consumer. And a growing portion of that is coming out of debt. If you don't have the cash, you can only pay for education three ways, right? Out of your family, one from savings, two from part-time jobs, or three, debt. Or obviously the family can put the money in rather than the part-time job. But and there is a growing, Minnesota ranks fifth in the nation right now, fifth, $29,000 in the amount of debt per baccalaureate degree. Now only two-thirds borrow, so a third don't borrow. They come out free, or come out, you know, they've been able to make it. But in our generation, it was more like 80% had no debt. So that has just dramatically changed. Two-thirds, that has gone up just in the last 15 or 20 years from about 50% to 75% who borrow. And they are borrowing more and more. The overall numbers, when you hear this number nationally, about $1 trillion in student debt, that's true because people are borrowing more. And it is also true that the largest amount of borrowing in dollars is for people who choose to go to St. Thomas, because they're willing to pay a premium, apparently, to go there. But underneath all that is, even if you choose to go to a two-year college, your debt levels are going up pretty significantly. Maybe not as in dollar amounts, not as much at maybe St. Thomas. But one of the things, we've been examining this issue pretty closely, McAllister and Carleton have lower debt, students have lower debt when they graduate than kids coming out of the university or out of public institutions. Not 2 years, because you got to scale that. So they are, I think they are doing something. You can't just assume they just have all rich kids. They are doing something to manage that, apparently, in the market. Apparently the families who choose to go there are willing to only take on so much debt. So this debt issue is becoming really, really significant in Minnesota. So those three charts talk about debt and stuff. I won't go through specifically. And then, now here's the public institution argument. This is this chart. And I mean this just by way of information. I don't mean it to discount the argument, because this is absolutely true. This is the rate of investment in public institutions in higher ed. Minnesota is ahead of the pack nationally in disinvesting dollars to the institutions than other states in the country. So, Chancellor Rosenstone is absolutely right about that. And this chart shows that. Our appropriations for higher ed, this one, our appropriations for higher ed in the last 15 years have been going down. Real dollar cuts to higher education. That is absolutely true. This chart, I won't go through the numbers, but this next chart on grant aid. In Minnesota, we have about $170 million or $160 million in aid that we give to students. That pales in terms of the amount of Pell Grant money that comes into the state. So in terms of the big picture, most of this grant aid money is Pell money from the federal government. It's that way in every state. In Minnesota, we add on more than most people in other states, our Minnesota version. But even when we do that, compared to what they're doing nationally, I mean, compared to what the feds are doing, it's a relatively small percentage of the package for most students. When people talk about financial aid, they usually are talking about grants and loans. And so you always want to separate, all right, do you mean the grant part or do you mean the loan part? Because we know loans are going up. Okay, here's what I briefly then wanted to really talk about. Here's how financial aid works. That's this chart. And I'm going to try to simplify it, and I'm going to describe to you what the problem is. In Minnesota, back in about 25 years ago, Gus Dunhow, who used to be at the university, also was Commissioner of Finance, Brandel, Moe, Perpich, they created something in Minnesota that is viewed as a national model. It's called the Shared Responsibility Model of Financial Aid. And it's set up in a way where we come in after the feds put in their federal grant and aid, we come in on top of that and try to do better for our priorities. We try to do better for lower income students, and we try to do better for middle income students. So when Pell money goes up, if you don't change anything, state grant money goes down. So it's set up to work in unison. And the way it's set up is there are three responsibilities, a shared responsibility. The first one is, and that's this under this thing called the model, the first portion is the student's responsibility. Every student should have money, should have skin in the game. So the first thing is, you're going to pay 46% of what it is, whatever it is, to get your college degree. And that is based on a principle that there is a private good involved here. You get a good education, you're going to get a better job, you're going to make more money. So there's some kind of ROI concept, return on investment concept there. And it's about student risk. What kind of degree are you going to get? How much do you think you're going to get in return for that in the workforce? So the notion there is, to start out, whatever the cost of attendance is, you as a student are going to pay 46% of it. The other 54% is going to be paid for by the family or by the taxpayer. That's this above the line. That's the public good portion here. There's a public interest in having you get more education. So this shared responsibility notion is there's both personal responsibility and public responsibility. And in the public side, based on income, the taxpayers could theoretically pick up the difference. But even when the taxpayers pick up the full 54% under the current setup, the student still is supposed to work part-time or take on debt or have savings to pay their 46%. So for many, many years, there's never been a notion here that the public pays for your post-secondary education. This has been a long time in Minnesota that this has been set up this way. So that system works beautifully if it's calibrated correctly to the actual costs of getting a post-secondary education. That works great, because then if you have no income, you know, basically you're in poverty, all you basically have to do is pay for your first 46% through a job or through savings or debt, and be wise which choice you make about where you go to school. Because if you decide you're going to St. Thomas, the public's not picking that portion up for you. You got to take, you know, you've got some risk here. So if you decide to take a higher cost education, if you decide to go to the University of Minnesota versus Mankato State or a two-year college, you're personally going to pay more too. So you always, this thing is calibrated by certain amount of risk calculation by the student, based on this notion that it's not all public good here. There's some private good involved. What you're going to get out of this. So under this model, this is the way the dollars are set up today. The state law says we assume, this is for the University of Minnesota. It's different for Minsku or Mankato State. But at the University of Minnesota, we assume under law that it costs $17,488 a year to go there. $10,400 in tuition and $7,000 in living expenses. The thinking on living expenses is if you're a student, you can't be in the workforce. So that's some kind of trade-off for not being in the workforce. And under that system, I have a chart in here. On the back here, U of M. The way this works is $17,000 is the recognized price. Assigned student responsibility is $8,000. That's 46%. That's this portion is $8,000. And then the Pell Grant comes in, leaving $9,400. The Pell Grant comes in at $55,000. That's the max. So if you're at the lowest income, you get a maximum Pell Grant of $5,500, leaving $3,988. And then we give, if you're low income, the state gives you a $3,988 grant to go to the U of M. Meaning, in the lowest incomes, this entire 56% has been paid for by either the federal government or the state with no loans. So the maximum loan, if you're not doing part-time work or something, would be $8,000 here, if you had to borrow the total amount. So that's how the system, that's the deal we offer students. The second chart shows, though, what's going on in reality, though. We have this calibrated incorrectly. The more realistic cost to go to the University of Minnesota is $26,000. Now you'll see in today in the paper they're saying 24. Technical matters. It's the same number. What they say in the paper today is $24,000 with both tuition and fees is the same as this number. It's just what assumptions you're making and stuff.
And that's per year.
Per year. So in the what's going on in reality, the system works great for that low-income student if it recognizes reality. What I'm arguing is that we don't recognize reality, because the real cost to go to the U is about $26,000. Tuition's about $14,000 or $12,000 if you calculate it like the U did. And living expenses are closer to $12,000 a year, not $7,000 a year. The poverty for a single individual in the United States right now is $8,300. So the number we're recognizing for living expenses for a student is below the poverty level right now. Just seems unrealistic. The $12,000 figure is based on national work about what are housing costs in your area, how much does food cost, how much does clothing cost. So $12,000 is what the professionals would say is kind of what it really costs to be a single person not in the workforce to live. You know, dormitory, food, etc. So the system breaks down because now 46% of that is not $8,000, it's really closer to 60, or your portion of that now is closer to 62%, which is $16,000. So a student thinks the deal is, well, I only got to pay this $8,000 based on the student financial aid model, but in essence, they have to pay twice as much because of the real world. That's why people are taking on debt. The deal they think they're working on is not reality. And this same model, this implicit student responsibility that is higher than the 48%, is the same, the chart's the same for a Minscu student or a four-year college student or St. Thomas student. But this, St. Thomas is capped out at the university's number, so you look at the U as the same as St. Thomas, basically. And you pick up more in your personal responsibility if you choose St. Thomas over the U. So there's this implicit amount that is, in many instances, double what you kind of are calibrating your calculation on. And that's why people are going into debt. So what we're thinking about, suggesting, is that we ought to fix the model so that people actually know what the deal is. When they make their calculation on their own ROI for what kind of degree they're going for, you know, I'm going to go to St. Thomas, here's the kind of job I think I'll get, I'm going to go to the U, here's the kind of job I think I'm going to get. And we all know that people put different value on those for different reasons. You know, Diane thought Augsburg was better than the U. She went to Augsburg. Okay.
Cheaper.
Huh?
It was cheaper.
When she did all the financial aid stuff.
Yeah.
And so then the last chart just shows, this one shows that if you did all this, you would really have an assigned responsibility of $12,000, roughly. So you're telling somebody, now you're making a personal choice on your educational, can you afford $12,000 or not? And the taxpayer then would pick up, in this instance, that student I just described, the taxpayer would pick up twice as much for that student as we pick up today. And make it possible for that student then to decide, can I afford? And again, this whole bottom portion is about an individual judgment about how much do I think my degree is going to be worth. Eventually. That's the private good portion. But the public good is totally based on income. If you're really poor, the taxpayer is going to pick it up. If you've got some income, if you've got family income, the family could pick it all up. That's where we're at. This is pretty expensive. This other line is if we put in some money to actually help the middle class more. Going from this red line over, a lot of people think the middle class kind of goes up to 100,000 now. It's not, you know, it's not as low as we used to think it was. And so there's a lot of pressure politically to do more for the middle class. And you can put money in and figure out a way to move that line this way so that more people get some financial aid from the state. let me leave it at that. And oh, I was going to say, this is depending on, there's many ways you can calculate this, but this could be somewhere between $150 to $400 million a year to just fix the system to make it look like it's reality. And those numbers move around because, you know, instead of saying it costs you $12,000 to live, we could say, all right, let's put it at the poverty rate. Let's put it at $8,300. We've done a calculation that instead of the $12,000, we say, all right, let's just assume we're not going to pay for apparel. Just take that out of the calculation. Just say that's a private choice. If you want new clothes, if you want any clothes, you got to pay that for that yourself. The guy in my office said, gee, Larry, how do you take apparel out? He says, are we expecting them to go nude? And I said, no, we're saying that I guess they're just not going to buy clothes while they're in college. They're going to wear the same clothes they got. You know, there's some semblance of personal choice there. Whereas the amount you pay for rent is not so much personal choice. The amount you have to pay to eat is not so much personal choice. So you can calibrate this somewhere between $150 million and $400 million a year. The Mercedes version is $400 million a year. The Northeast version is, well, at least do $150 million a year. So it's the reality, it's got to be somewhere in between there. Let me leave it at that and try to answer questions. Again, I am absolutely arguing that the most fundamental thing Minnesota should be doing right now, this is my argument. I'm not saying this is what Diane and Phyllis and Carrie are going to decide, or Mark. What I'm arguing is, for any dollar we have right now, the most important thing we could do in higher ed is try to fix the financial aid system to maintain legitimate access for people to choose the post-secondary experience that best fits their aspirations and abilities. So it's really an equity argument. I'm arguing that it's unfair to ask somebody with very little income to take too big of a risk and take out too much debt because it only works out on average. If it works out, that's great. But if it doesn't work out on average for you, your entire life has been affected. Barack Obama and his wife paid off their debt apparently just 2 or 3 years ago. Now, they got law degrees, postgraduate degrees. They took out a lot of debt to do that. And it worked out for them, apparently. But even though he was a faculty member, he still hadn't paid off his debt until he was in his 40s. Think about the kid who is making the choice to go to auto mechanic school 2 years, taking on debt, and then there's not an auto mechanic job when they get out of school. Then they got to start all over. Or think about the kid. All of this financial aid stuff is for undergraduates. Basically, we're not talking grad school here. So the way I think we should think about it is, this is the challenge for this generation of policymakers is really this access issue. And in Minnesota, for 25 years, we have decided that access means the choice by the student as to what type of institution best fits their capacities and their aspirations. So we have no bias between public and non-public institutions there. So let's open it up. Phyllis.
Inaugurated in Maine, so there's a model and the payoff, which is that if you then get the reduction of the debt that pays the debt, mm-hmm. that pays a certain amount of reduction each year that you work in the state that essentially pays the debt off or cuts it way down. And as I said, I believe that the state of Maine has this as a model, and it, you know, broke even in terms of keeping people with good incomes in the state. I think it broke even in 3 years and started paying for more than itself in 10 years. You know, what about those two?
We should do all of that. Minnesota actually has, we have something called self-loans in Minnesota, where we actually can provide a lower interest rate for kids who take out debt. We absolutely should do all those things. The point I'm making, though,
I mean,
until you fix this. At the federal level, they basically give loan forgiveness at a certain point, and all there's all kinds of mechanisms. All good. Argument I'm making, though, is on the front end, we are buying into much more debt than is fair. That's the argument I'm making. I'm arguing that we need to fix this, and then we should be doing things like that. If we do just those things, there are going to be, in some respects, a lot of left behinds who were forced into decisions that were not wise for them to make, because you only succeed on average in this system. So I'm not disagreeing, Phil, so I'm just saying priorities first.
I got a couple points of clarification and about 18 questions. First one, one of the earliest sheets that you passed out, not immediately related to higher education, but did I see that 64% of Minnesota high school students are not prepared for college?
Yes.
Okay, so that's a problem.
Absolutely.
Yeah, okay. And then what percentage of those unprepared for college are going to the UK classes? Any of them?
Fewer, because they've raised entrance requirements. Most of those students end up at open enrollment institutions, which is minuscule.
Okay. All right. And then going back to the question about how you're concerned about the rising costs and the money that the state puts in, and yet they said the tuition seems to be responding to a different market mechanism. It wouldn't have occurred to me that a university, speaking about a university, not a four-year teaching college,
right,
but specific to universities, it would strike me that what is driving their costs as much as anything is the investment in professors in an effort to stay competitive with everybody else so that they can get more research dollars. So in effect, if you know, it's kind of like the NFL. As much money as we pour in, there's always going to be somebody who's going to pay more for Alex Rodriguez.
First on the remedial issue. This demographic issue is that fewer kids coming through the pipeline to post-secondary are prepared to do the work. That's obviously a problem we have in K-12 that Don and others are working on. You're going to hear a discussion about reinventing or redesigning 11 through 14 by Casilius, Rosenstone, Commissioner of Education, Chancellor, and myself. That's about this issue. Try to push as much remedial work out of post-secondary institutions as possible by identifying gaps in education earlier in high school and then trying to do something about it. That's the trade-off for letting the kid who's ready to do post-secondary work, setting them free. Let them go do post-secondary work, which should free up resources to then deal with the student who's not prepared. So that's what's going on there. At Normandale, West Bloomington, I think that campus is, 70% of the incoming students take at least one remedial course. And it's usually math or reading. Keep in mind that 70% includes people coming back from the workforce too. So the way people talk about it is roughly 50% aren't prepared to do post-secondary work when they leave high school. So that's on remedial. This other issue about the university, there's a differentiated mission here for the University of Minnesota. It's the only research institution out of all of these, whoever is in the higher ed area in Minnesota, The U is the one who's got the research function. Presumably it costs, if you've got a research faculty member, they don't teach full time, they maybe teach 75% of the time, that costs you more. It maybe costs you more because you're in an international market for that particular professor. That costs you more. So the question for policymakers is, do you try to figure out a way to buy down tuition at the U, or do you help pay for the research function? And I think the university's request is kind of both. The university's saying, give us money for research, if you read the morning paper, but also give us money to buy down tuition. And I think what confronts policymakers is, I think they should think clearly about that and say, how can I most effectively help that institution, dollar for dollar? Obviously, you can tell I think it's on the research side, not on the tuition side. Because keep in mind, what's going on here, if this is a market, what's going on is full-pay students are subsidizing other students. If you're at a private college, as an example, the most clear example is a private college. Someone who's willing to pay $50,000 to go to Carleton, and there are some, that's not what it costs that kid to get that education at Carleton. Carleton's taking that money and putting it somewhere else. The U does that too for certain students, not as many as Carleton. Although the university would argue that wherever they set tuition, it's below the... They will argue it's below the cost of actually educating the student. Strike me down, Fitz and Ryder and Kaler. I don't think we really know whether it's above or below. And I think I'm arguing, again, this is me, not Mark Dayton, I'm arguing that it almost is a futile exercise for Mark and Diane and Carrie and Phyllis to try to figure that out. Because there's so many numbers in play here. Randy.
I just want to say I talked to you earlier, and I don't think we can separate military spending and this whole corruption of Bush administration, all the money we wasted, trillions of dollars.
Well, Randy, let me just say this. That absolutely, federal level, doesn't affect our state budget, the military spending.
But
I don't disagree. If the feds would have chosen more Pell money versus Iraq, things would be better.
And before, I just want to say the worst thing you did, Phyllis, was not support impeachment.
Bush.
When the Minsky system was established in the early 90s, it was quite controversial. The leaders of the individual systems, community colleges, state universities, technical schools weren't quite sure they wanted to be thrust into one big pot.
Right.
Can you comment a little bit about how Minsky has worked out in practice over the years since it's been in effect?
Yeah, the question is, did the combination of the 2 years and the 4-year colleges into Minsky system, how has that worked out? What has happened, I think, and Phyllis should add to this, is that there's been resistance to accepting the fact that that's what happened. And I think that's faded away now. I think people now accept the system is a central office with both technical education, 2-year baccalaureate, 2-year associates, and 4-year baccalaureates in it. Whether it's working effectively or not, and whether that was the right choice, you hear both sides of that. Every time there's high unemployment, the skills gap discussion starts. And everybody then claims the reason we have that is because we took the technical education out of the high schools and we destroyed the technical college system. When unemployment's low, you hear less of that. So I don't know whether it's working or not. I'm trying to accept it as it is. Rosenstone's trying to focus, Chancellor Rosenstone is trying to focus the effort more on workforce than it appears to be focused right now. He just had 55 community meetings with business leaders to talk about how do we prepare the kind of students you need for the workforce. But my observation, I think Phyllis might agree with this, that the discussion about that ebbs and flows with the economy. When the economy is doing really well, it seems to all be working out. When the economy is not doing well, then there's a problem with education's role in preparing people for the workforce. Yes.
And so I think it's really working, close for people to go to a low cost place for a couple of years or PSEO or something and then end up in the university.
Absolutely. I think there's general recognition. But no, I think there's general recognition that to the extent that you view learning as more of a lifelong continual process, it has become much easier to transition through, for many students, to transition through a technical or two-year kind of program into a four-year kind of program for that kind of student. It has really helped students who are not your traditional, I'm leaving high school, I'm going to get a four-year baccalaureate. I think there's very little disagreement about how that combination of putting them together, I think most people agree that has really helped that kind of student. And that's an emerging, a growing number of kids, students. Mary Ann?
I've been thinking a fair amount lately about the fact that everybody here is familiar with the bell curve or Maynard's intelligence. And that means, in essence, half the population has an IQ under 100. I don't know what IQ would be considered, what's required to go into a traditional four-year college. My own experience was a liberal arts education. But I'm wondering the extent to which our school system, both K-12 and post-secondary, is geared to the needs and the abilities of that lower half number and making it productive both for our economy and for the individuals. It's so easy to think higher education plus graduate education and so forth and so on. And we just can't continually say everybody should go to college. It's not going to work.
Okay, I think you'll notice that there's been a transition in discussion, hopefully, that kind of the liberal mantra was college for all. That is transitioning into post-secondary attainment for all to make space for what you just described. Because we know that not every job, the baccalaureate is the thing that makes most sense. By the same token, we know not every student that's prepared to do a baccalaureate would be the kind of person that we'd want to be in that other type of job. So the attempt here is to try to broaden. The data shows that more post-secondary attainment's necessary. Brenda Casilius, the K-12 commissioner, she says we ought to just say that 12 years isn't enough. You've got to have a 14-year degree education for the basics. This is this whole soft skill discussion that you hear from the business community. There's a lot of evidence that that's true, that everybody needs a much higher level of just kind of general citizen of the democracy, liberal education. But at the same time that's happening, it's become pretty clear that the job market is demanding very specific capacities for some jobs that are much higher level than they used to be. They talk about welders and stuff. To be a welder today is a much higher level proposition than it was 30 years ago. Huh? So you got to do both at once. But I think, no, there's a recognition, Marianne, that not everybody is on what we consider the academic baccalaureate track.
I'm wondering whether
Yeah. Part of the, I mentioned this 11 to 14 redesign. Part of that notion is to say, let's help young people, both education and career or life plan, and what's the path to get to whatever that is, to meet your aspirations and your capacities. And so what's being talked about is kind of an app that you'd have on your cell phone or your iPad that has your, for young people, that has what are you doing in education, what are you planning on doing, and then you could literally push information to that that said, here's the kind of jobs there are. And then you would almost force this matching up of, are my aspirations in sync with what I'm actually doing? The simple example is, I would like to be a veterinarian. Oh, I might have to study science to do that? I'm overstating it here, but the idea would be to try to link for people earlier and earlier what it is that if they aspire to, they need to be considering. And also, I think to some degree, helping align people's aspirations with reality. Obviously, that's a pretty touchy kind of thing to talk about because we're against tracking. Our nationally, we don't believe in tracking. I doubt that we're going to undo that. But people are trying to think of a way to help people earlier come to some kind of understanding of what it would take to do what they aspire to do. And hopefully that'll squeeze out some of these inefficiencies. Jill?
The percentage of students that are choosing to leave Minnesota to pursue higher ed, is that number consistent or is that changing?
You know, I don't know what the trend line is on that right now. We do know that we have reciprocity with Wisconsin, North and South Dakota, and we know that more students are choosing to leave Minnesota to go to their institutions, and we think that's about price. Partly. Minnesota tends to have higher tuition rates than people around us. We think it's about price. We also have seen, though, as price has gone up, we've seen people opting out of, in some respect, St. Thomas to go to the U. The middle class kid who maybe can afford is making the choice to come to a less expensive institution because that's what they're doing. And that gets to this issue of, should we be subsidizing that choice by that student to choose the lower price institution? When we have a kid who's really stuck and maybe can't get into one of these institutions because they're unwilling to take on that kind of debt. That's really, that kind of summarizes kind of the argument. And it's really controversial what I just said. Right.
And, you know, is someone or your office starting to look at that? Because I was really struck that it's almost a third now of our total student body.
Absolutely. The type of student body we're talking about is changing pretty dramatically. Purists would argue that our financial aid system is slightly biased toward full-time or more, be in school more so you can graduate quicker. And so there's, I think MinSCU's actually coming with a proposal to do something for the part-time student directly. We've been talking about it. And so I think your point's well taken. We got to figure out a way, do we want, there's this trade-off here. The data's pretty overwhelming. The quicker you get your education, the less expensive it is. and the more responsive to the workforce. That's why there's kind of been this bias toward, get serious, get your education, get done. But in the world we live in now, with more and more people doing it at later and later ages or lifelong learning, it may be that that bias doesn't make as much sense anymore. So yeah, that absolutely, that's under discussion by everybody. Minsky's going to have a proposal specific. They talk about it as give us money for part-time students, and we can have a longer, we will have a longer discussion about that. There's some nuances to that. Because the truth is, they've got most of the part-time students, and so for their institutional reasons, they would like you to give a ton of money for that purpose.
Most of us have attended these institutions, and they're asking us to give financially back to them. So where does philanthropy fit into the equation?
Oh, that's what's used to buy, at private institutions, that's what's used to buy down the overall list price for everybody, or a lot of philanthropists have done it for specific things. What the university tells me is that the people with money are really asking for really specific things now, and some don't want to do tuition. They want to do pay for graduate students, or they want to do something specifically in research. So I think the answer is they have a smorgasbord of opportunities for you to give your money to them for various things. Well, we have the Roger Page Scholarship, which is that for tuition? What is that used for?
That's used for tuition.
Okay, but that was the choice that you guys made.
Yeah.
The emphasis is on scholarships.
Okay, then.
And university, I attended university, and the university is coming every month, if not every week, with some sort of contribute to the.
And then the thing to differentiate there is there are merit scholarships. Because they want to get a particular student because of their academic capabilities. And then there are income, need scholarships. And our financial aid program, the state's one, the one the taxpayers paid for, is all, it's not merit. It's all based on need. And I think that's part of the argument. That seems like something that should be the public's responsibility if you believe in equity and fairness. We should make sure that based on need, people have opportunity. Whereas clearly for these institutions, merit-based aid is smart because they want to get a mix of students based on a lot of different factors. And they may want that particular pianist because they need that to fill out kind of their student body. So. No. I absolutely, when you talk to the educators, trust me, they have not given up on the liberal education. I mean, the private colleges, that's their whole thing. We prepare citizens for the democracy with value type thing. University of Minnesota talks about that all the time. So no, that has not gone. What I think has changed is the universality of post-secondary education. Years ago, there was a pretty select group that went to post-secondary education. It was a different thing. Now it's universal. Our notion is universal post-secondary education. Otherwise, our economy will get suppressed for lack of workforce. That's what I think the difference is. And then what I'm arguing, and again, me, not my boss, what I'm arguing, I hope he'll argue this, but I don't know if he will. What I'm arguing is what has also changed is the financing of this. It is a market system, whether we like it or not, and that the public's role should be to ensure access. It's Kaler and Rosenstone's and Rosenberg at McAllister. It's their job to ensure quality and the balance between how much does it cost to provide quality versus not. I think it's tough for a legislator or a governor. How do you weigh in on the quality issue? I mean, how do you affect that? That's what I'm arguing. That's what we pay Kaler and Rosenstone to ensure. And that what we should focus on as taxpayers is access.
Larry?
Fairness, equity. Yep.
Right now, is there any kind of high school exit counseling on careers for families and prospective students? Because, you know, if a student says, you know what, I'm going to pay $45,000 a year or whatever it is to go to McAllister so that I can be an elementary school teacher, is there anybody suggesting to that student that that might not be the best use of what ends up being maybe $250,000?
I think it's happening in different ways. I mean, we have one of the lowest counselor ratios in Minnesota, like by far,
yeah.
You know, 1 to 800 or something. It's really not good. So I think the path to fix it with counselors is not coming soon. And so I think people are trying to do it through media. And I guarantee you, there are discussions with financial aid people at whatever institution you're trying. There are discussions going on there about why it would be worth it for you to come to our institution for that price, et cetera, et cetera. What we're trying to do is, and Obama's been working on this, he's got an agreement with, I think, 10 universities around the country, to come up with a uniform financial aid letter of some sort so that you literally could compare the Carleton offer with the university, with Augsburg, with St. Cloud State, and then understand what your choices are. That's the other thing that leads me to believe, since I'm watching the action around what's going on here, that's why I think we are in a market system. Because people are asking that exact question. I won't use anybody's name, although this is a family that lives in our neighborhood. I had represented this area for 30 years. I get this job, and about a day after I get it, this person, who's got a really good job as an attorney, comes running up to me at Lund's. And says, Larry, now that you got this job, will you do something about the cost of higher education? And he's kind of complaining. Then he finally says, at least I should be able to compare these offers between the schools. To me, that's a clear indication that we are in a market system, whether we like it or not. Because here's a person who's smart enough to know, all right, I live by the U. My kid could go to the U. My kid could go out state. My kid could go to 2-year community. This person knows what the options are, and they are making some kind of calculation based on these various things. I mean, Diane straight up said it. She says it was cheaper for me to go to Augsburg. And you obviously then thought that Augsburg degree was as good or better than the higher cost option. Were you right, or do you know?
Huh?
Now, I'm not arguing that everybody has perfect knowledge here and that the market is perfect. I'm not arguing that at all. I'm just saying that there's got to be some recognition that that's what's going on here.
Just to follow up on that market comment, if the perception begins to take hold, and maybe it is that the return on investment is really not there, family, your kid is 30 years old, he's got $50,000 of debt, and he's still working as a barista at Starbucks, if that perception begins to take hold, what impact is that going to have on higher education?
Well, I think that does bring price down. Let me make two examples here, and I'm just surmising. I'm not saying I believe this. So Concordia College in St. Paul, low-income neighborhood. They basically have no full-pay students anymore. It's a private college, but no full-pay students. They've decided instead of advertising a $29,000 price, they're going to advertise a $19,000 price. They've obviously decided, since they have no more full pay or very few full pay students at $29,000, that it's not in their interest to advertise that price any longer. A real cynic, I'm not one of them, would argue that the market has already kicked in for the University of Minnesota and they're going to freeze tuition. Now, on the way out the door, they're going to ask Diane and Phyllis for $42 million to freeze tuition. And I guess what I'm saying is maybe we ought to test the proposition to find out what's really going on. Again, I'm not trying to be cynical, but I think we really don't know if some of our institutions are, if they're being protected from a market unreasonably, even though they're in a market. Because, I mean, think about our beloved university. I've been there 30 years. I love them. Matter of fact, they used to call me in the Senate. They'd say, oh, God, Mr. University, he'll do whatever they want. But it is true that this year the university is asking this, Diane and Phyllis to give them $42 million to freeze tuition. Well, it wasn't so long ago, 2 years ago and 4 years ago, the university argued, we set tuition, get out of our business. Which is it? And again, I don't mean that cynically, I'm just saying. Which is it? Because I think it's true, the university, and I think they should always come back and tell policymakers, we're a land-grant institution, get out of our business. And I think that's good, because the truth of the matter is, Eric Kaler gets paid $750,000 to run that really important institution. Don't we trust that he's making these judgments about value, cost, and stuff, and is probably in a better position to do that than Diane and Phyllis? That's kind of what I'm arguing. I'm absolutely certain the university will tell us that without their $42 million contribution, tuition will have to go up.
Just, are you looking at what's going on in other places? Like, I mean, half my family lives in Canada. So we've already marched in a student protest march to keep tuition down in Quebec. And I think it was actually effective.
Well, look at Cal. Okay, let's do somewhere not close, but in our own economy, California. They basically have had free tuition at their community colleges forever, right? Well, that ain't what's going on now. It's going like this. Now, it is true that they can double their tuition for a few years and still not catch up to where we are. But I guess it gets down to, do you think with tax dollars, you can change the march of the economy or the reality? Or do you think you gotta kind of work with what you got? I'm clearly arguing you gotta work with what you got. Now, I absolutely agree that if you're willing to put in $3 billion, we can maybe go back to that world where we basically said we're having low tuition at college so people can get in. Maybe even philosophically, I would say we should do that. But then I look at where we're at and I kind of go, boy, doesn't seem likely right now, and that we should be really worried about that kid who does not have equity in terms of access to their post-secondary experience. That scares me a bit, a lot, because the amount of debt that lower income people are taking on is really risky relative to what they're going to get in the end. Less risky than my family when I make that choice, because, you know, at the end, you know, we'll probably figure it out. But there's just a growing number of young people that don't have that protection. You know, we can afford, some of us maybe can afford to make the wrong choice. Others might not. And obviously there are very wealthy people, or not even very wealthy, but there are some people that are willing to pay Harvard, whatever the price is, probably full well knowing that the ROI isn't exactly right. But they still do it, right? Because apparently they can afford to do it and choose to do it. And what I always tell people when they think, Larry, you're getting a little... I always say, no, I'm still in the camp for our Sky Lee, now that Jill's not here, for our Sky Lee and our Gia, I still believe that if they get into Harvard or Juilliard, we're going to figure it out. Even though I fully know that that return on investment may not quite be there, because I may be willing to say, okay, but it might be. But that's not a choice that a growing number of people have the opportunity or the luxury of making that choice. And it's also true that I might be unrealistic. If our kids get into Harvard, maybe I won't be able to afford that. So that kind of discussion goes on all the time. The feds have already, for their federal loans, they've already got quite a few mechanisms to protect you from going into default. Delay payments, only a certain amount of your income can be. But it absolutely is true that it's almost impossible to have student debts forgiven. Almost impossible. Eventually you're going to pay. But there are programs or there are approaches to say if you go into teaching, it gets forgiven, or if you go into something. The only issue there is you have to start to think about how good are we at making those choices for people about what they choose to do with their life. And I think there's some cautions there, I think.
Whatever it is going on now is not working.
Well, what I'm arguing, and I know, and again, this is hard for us, I think it's hard for all of us to accept. We love our institutions, but it is a fact that tuition and fees have gone up at 2.5 times the inflation rate for years. So now you can jump into whose fault that is, or can that be changed, or whatever. But it is factual that that's what's happened. At the same time, the level of public investment in higher education has either stabilized or kind of slipped down. With those two facts in mind, it seems to me we need to think about, we can't just sit there and wish the way the world should be. We need to think about how can you most effectively use whatever public dollar you have to impact that dynamic. And what I'm arguing is it should be about the access issue. That's our safest bet. And I guess then by correlation, and now really strike me down, university and Fitz and Rader, I'm saying that we basically have to trust the market forces to bend the cost curve in higher ed. Because we're not strong enough to do it. I hope that doesn't sound like I'm throwing in the towel. I'm trying to recognize what I believe appears to be reality.